BlackScholarsPublishing.com.
That we should get our own. Once we have our own, we're respected for the fact that we can create our own. And that's equality right there.
Start a record label, Miss Fish just did it. Nylon cover 5 minutes.
Woo. We are too high in the building. About to make a movie independent. Woo! Still an icon living. Welcome to the Black Scholars Podcast. I am your host, Leonard Andre Wilson Jr. Hope you guys are having a good school year thus far. We are about 7 weeks in at my school district. Looking forward to fall break, as many of us are who start super early. This is episode 11. I want to thank you guys for your support. Thank you for your emails, your DMs. I appreciate all of it. This particular episode features Tanisha Boyd of Mobile County Public Schools. She's originally from Detroit, but she now works in Alabama in a rural area. Very similar to myself, I'm also from the Midwest, and I also work in what they would consider a rural area. Nevertheless, enjoy the show. Don't forget, Black Scholar Tees are available at BlackScholarsPublishing.com. You can subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Play, or even Podbean. Episode 11. Let's get into it.
I got him for Lauren. I just had dinner with D. Obama. What did you do? Hop up on Twitter talking about the stuff you don't do. Rock off a lawn, shawty, cause that is what you gon' do. Sabi out of New Balance, I'm styling like a Zosu. God with the Pro Tools, boss in the good dude. Ball like it's good, man. Watts, you can come through. Boy, at the farms, I'm the city voice. At the farms, all you hear is oi. One time for BDR, we just trying to see you out. I used to be with Nas, beating Nuri City up. Why should you talking to one respect about the OGs? Rappers was wearing garbage, I put them on the Supreme. I got no problems from anybody on the TV. Cause I got some partners from Chopper, Chopper, Chopper City. Old time, really. Coldest in my city, coldest in my county. Who's messing with me? I was selling sneakers, I was selling CDs. Now I'm selling streams and women's dreams that need me. I be seeing fiends that used to be official. So I speak to God and tell him, please forgive me. I've been ungrateful, I'm thankful. I've been ungrateful, I'm thankful. I've been ungrateful, but thankful. I've been ungrateful, but thankful.
So let's go ahead and get into it. Welcome to the Black Scholars Podcast. Please introduce yourself to everyone, first and last name. Let them know where you teach, what you teach, how long you've been teaching, what brought you into teaching. Just overall, just a background story of you and your educational career.
Sure. My name is Tanisha Boyd. I have been teaching now 17 years. I teach now 8th grade English language arts. I'm currently working and have been here for almost 7 years in Mobile, Alabama. I teach at Lott Middle School, which is in a rural area. Initially, I started teaching college, freshman and sophomore English. And when I decided to become certified, I was teaching in Detroit, pretty much right in the heart of it at a charter school, which was an experience in and of itself. I decided to start teaching, which is probably not the typical reason. I had plans to be a doctor, and I was going to make a lot of money and buy cute stuff. And then I took chemistry and physics, and it told me that my path would be different. So I had to regroup and figure out what I was good at. And I ended up doing a type of summer mentoring program with some students, and I realized that they couldn't speak or write in just basic English. And I started wondering what happened. I started subbing while I was working as an instructional assistant as well, and decided that I would get certified to teach English and do secondary education. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Awesome. And so, well, let's go into this first. I also teach eighth grade English. I also have sixth grade and seventh grade, because I've got the gifted kids or gifted students. And I'm just going to be honest. Out of the three groups, the eighth grade group is my least favorite. That's 2 years in a row that I am not really enjoying teaching the eighth grade English students. I think it's because I come from a high school background and I've dealt with ninth graders before. And so I see a huge similarity in characteristics and traits between eighth graders and ninth graders. And it's really hard to describe for anyone who's never taught either age group. They're interesting. It's an interesting bunch. How's that going for you?
So I'm the opposite. I love eighth grade. I am not a fan of sixth and seventh grade because they are very different in each group. Sixth grade is still trying to figure out what it means to be an independent learner and have that responsibility thrust upon them, and they're still very emotional. Seventh grade, it's a weird time. Hormones start to kick in. They're happy Monday at 8 o'clock, and Monday at 12 o'clock, their whole life fell apart. And then by 1 o'clock, they're all back together again. Eighth grade, I find to be, they are challenging, but I find them to be more interesting in the sense that they figured it out and they recognize that within the school, if it's a true middle school, they are the top dogs. They're the seniors, so to speak. And so they like that whole, I'm older, I know more, we're leaving here. And so for me, academically, I think it gives teachers a little more leeway. You have a little more power over them because they recognize they won't move away. They won't move on unless they can get it right with you. So I actually enjoy them and listening to their ways of thinking. I love it.
Well, let me clarify. You're absolutely right. I do indeed enjoy them academically. That's never been an issue. Those are my seventh graders last year. Academically, I can go farther with them, especially in discussions when we do, the seminars and the literature circles. We can take a theme or a motif and take it to another level. In that particular group, maybe I mean behavior-wise with eighth grade, and it's only for me. It's only a couple who they're very disinterested, disengaged, and that's not uncommon dealing with a gifted group. There's usually one or two in there that I think they call them underachievers or low achievers, despite the fact that they are intellectually capable of doing a high level of work. And that's really what I'm trying to figure out. But I can take an example. So if I give an example of symbolism, and they will run with it like that, they want that to be the discussion for the entire class. And it's a good discussion, but it's not actually aligned to standard, right? Like it's not actually the lesson plan. It just was an example. So yeah, that's the issue I'm having with eighth grade. But I 100% agree with you. Academically, you can go a lot farther with them.
I think they like to push the envelope a little bit. They sometimes, I have taught seniors in high school, and I think sometimes they forget, that this year is all the other years were important prior, but it's really important now that we, align ourselves with, the expectations of procedures and policies and, follow through and the responsibility and accountability. They seem to let those things slip sometimes, because I think because they're in that senior position. And so they can be challenging in that way. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's always just a couple. I have two honors classes within my day, and they are leveled, you know, level one and level two. And I see that, you know, there's always one or two that will become disengaged. And not always, but sometimes I found when I, you know, look at test scores and I kind of engage them in conversation, they are so far beyond what we're talking about.
Right.
That they don't want to be engaged in what and what's going on, because they are thinking differently. And they don't necessarily know what that is, but I found that I have to do some pretty quick work with my honors students to kind of capture those kids, because if not, they will become a nightmare for you.
Right, absolutely. And one of the methods I've used to kind of turn that around, I'm thinking of one eighth grader specifically, is I've basically turned him into my assistant.
And
I have him grade papers, I have him, you know, collect papers, I have him distribute papers, and that little piece of autonomy has, you know, kind of switched, you know, his disengagement, where he's a little bit more engaged now and he's actually starting to do his work. But he's still, his particular story would take an entire podcast episode, because he's surrounded by underachievers. He's surrounded by... He has brothers who have been in and out of jail.
Wow.
And a mom who is being pulled by too many different people, and she can only do but so much. He doesn't know his dad. And yeah, it's just there's outside things that are factoring to his academic motivation right now. But he's a good kid nevertheless. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, you like you said, you got to figure it out. You got to figure it out, because we can't go the whole year with him disengaged and not living up to his expectations. So,
right.
Exactly. Now, you also mentioned you work in a rural area. I can argue that I probably do so as well. Of course, everyone knows I'm in Memphis, Tennessee, but I'm actually right outside of Memphis in Millington, which is a naval base area. And there's a lot of horses out there, a lot of country land and farmland out there. It's pretty underdeveloped still, so I'm pretty sure it still qualifies as rural, because it's definitely not urban. How has that, and are you originally from Detroit? Or
yes.
So you're from Detroit, so you're from the Midwest. I'm actually originally from Milwaukee, Midwest. So Detroit should be bigger than Milwaukee, but I've been to Detroit before. Of course, you've probably been to Chicago before. So coming from a metropolitan, you know, mid to large size city, then coming down south, where you're down south now and I'm down south now, and we're both working in rural schools, how's that transition been for you? Was there a culture shock? How were you able to overcome that?
It wasn't. I am originally from Detroit. My mom moved to Alabama when I was 10, and I left when I was 20. And I came back seven years now. And so I didn't, you know, as a child, there are certain things that you don't understand about where you live. You just know that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that Detroit was nowhere near what this is. And after going back home and staying there and then coming back and having worked in an urban school where, you know, every school has their own issues. But when I accepted the position, culture shock is probably an understatement. because, you know, you do theory and you watch the news and you talk to other teachers and you go to conferences and you hear about their situations. But when you are placed in the midst of something that you have no tangible connection to, it does something to your whole psyche. When we lived in Mobile, we lived in a suburban area. So, you know, stores, cars, trees, pavement. My school is literally across the street from a cattle ranch.
Oh, wow.
Many of my students, I've had students tell me, you know, Ms. Boyd, I live behind the woods. I didn't even know what that meant. And it means that there are no power lines that run that far. So they're on generators. There connection to the outside world. I'm not saying that they're, you know, in the Stone Ages, but things that seem the norm, even with regard to what's going on in current news, they're almost oblivious to it. Because it's not a focal point in their small community, whether it be their family or their little neighborhood. Now they are on top of music and fashion, but I think that comes from coming into the school because other kids trickle in. And so they share that information. But I cried a lot in the principal's office my first year because I didn't understand why it wasn't important to do homework or to come to school on a regular basis. I've had students tell me several times, oh yeah, we didn't come to school because we were deer hunting. There's a grocery store down the street from the school. Why are we missing class? But that is the culture. And so I had to learn to adjust to what, I had to acknowledge what was. You know, I just couldn't come in there with my ideals and change it. I had to acknowledge this is what it is. And I had to figure out how to shift their thinking mm-hmm. about what was important. And that's still a struggle because those are big things. You know, Mardi Gras is, you know, a major event where I am. And, you know, the government shuts down on Fat Tuesday and kids don't do any assignments. They don't study because they have to ride from Mobile to where my school is. It's about 45 minutes away. It's like an experience, you know, when they come to the city. So, you know, we have to allot for those things. And it's just very different. Even the drive between watching kids who were avoiding gunfire on the way to school in Detroit to kids who are, you know, they may not have power on or have running water or, you know, be in some cases trying to raise themselves. And that, I think that's, you know, a national thing, but it looks different. And so until you know what it looks like, you know, you can't address it and figure out how to deal with it. So I'm still adjusting. This is year 7 at this school, and I'm still adjusting to their norms because they aren't mine yet.
So in those 7 years, has that community, that town, has there been some civic engagement or some type of community development? Are you seeing businesses pour in more, or is it still the same from 7 years ago?
It is essentially the same with regards to their economic status.
Okay.
The population is transient. You know, people move from Tennessee, Georgia, Mississippi, Florida, and it's a continual in and out, sometimes the same people, sometimes new. What I can say with regards to our particular school, our principal has been very hands-on and engaged in the community, reaching out, creating opportunities for parents to step into our world and not feel less than or intimidated. You know, that's sometimes an issue where parents who may not have education don't feel comfortable coming into the school and talking with teachers right. about what's going on with their student. You know, they'll talk to you about behavior, but academically, a lot of them cannot assist them right. or don't know how to assist them. So he's been very instrumental in creating avenues for that so that we have more of our parents now. This is his 4th year. So within the last 3 years, a lot of parents have started to feel more comfortable coming in, talking to teachers, coming to our after school events outside of athletics. So it's been nice to see that. It's been nice to have parents ask you, what do they have for homework? Do they have homework? And that's right. a question, you know, that makes a teacher's heart just burst with joy for a parent Absolutely. To be in concern. So I have seen that happen within our walls and hearing parents talk outside of our school about what's taking place. So even though the community in that particular area is not growing, there are things that are happening. We do have a movement for STEM.
Okay,
and
good.
we do have some companies. We have a steel mill out that way, which is maybe about another 30 minutes from where we are, and they are investing in our schools to push STEM. So every year we have a summer program, a STEM camp, and that is paid for by one of the companies out there because they want our students to be in a position to transition into positions that are available within their company. So we've been very, this will be our third year with that. So we're very excited about encouraging students to go in and then for them to see that, you know, you can get a job where, yeah, playing video games does have, there's a benefit, but it's on the other side. You know, so it's been very exciting to see students think about the things that they're already doing as possible job opportunities in the future and to be able to provide that income for their families when we have so many of them whose parents don't have those types of jobs or, you know, would never. You know, we have kids coming out of our high school, which is right down the street, that are coming out at $24 and $30 an hour because that company has partnered with our middle school, our elementary school, and our high school. So that's been very exciting.
Yeah, I love to see that parallel, that connection between, you know, companies there locally and actually schools. I've always argued that should be the case. I was blessed growing up in Milwaukee to attend a high school that had a co-op program. So during my part of my junior and my senior year, I would go to school pretty much up until about, I guess, like lunchtime, so about 10:30-ish. And then I'd spend the rest of the day actually at work. And I worked at a bank. So that taught me at a very young age how to be, you know, responsible and punctual and really start adopting and those professional traits that we want our kids to have. You know, just something simple as, you know, showing mannerisms and being able to, you know, look someone in the eyes and shake their hand and, you know, being able to tie a tie, you know, just the very simple things. So that's a fabulous program. You said you guys are going into year three for STEM?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And let me see. I think this might be year four or five for us with STEM. I'm not sure if we have 100% backing yet, but I know we do have some support from FedEx with us being in the Memphis area because I know what eighth grade they deal with advanced robotics. And I know FedEx is very interested in that technology. Also the, what is it? The blockchain technology, which, you know, a lot of the crypto is built on. They are starting to trying to integrate that into programming, as well. And I think seventh grade starts off with that. We're actually being able to code and program the actual robots. And then eighth grade, they take it to another level with advanced robotics. I'm not really sure what sixth grade STEM works on, but I'd have to think it'd be like some type of foundation for all of that. So awesome program. Awesome. Awesome. You also mentioned that you used to work at a charter school.
Yes.
I almost don't want to talk about this, but what was your experience at your charter school? How long were you there? You don't have to name the charter school, but how long were you there?
I was there for 4 years. That was my first official certified teaching position. I had been working in education, but I wasn't certified. I loved it. You know, I know that, you know, it doesn't matter, charter or public, it could go either way. I loved it. I had an amazing principal. The school was 100% African-American student population. We had a very diverse faculty, which I think was amazing because the world doesn't just look like you. But we were all on the same page in trying to make sure that our students had what they needed outside of education. You know, we were like the one-stop community shop, and it was because of our principal. And her job was solely to ensure that the faculty was doing their job and to make sure that our babies were taken care of. And then we had a dean of education, which focused on making sure that the teachers were following that curriculum and we were providing the supports necessary for our students. And so, you know, and then we because we didn't do assistant principals at that particular school. Mm-hmm. The days were, you know, just as long for any other teacher. But some things that I saw at that particular school that I think helped create the culture were, you know, once a week, it didn't matter whether how the teachers felt about it. There was an assembly to talk to our students about things that were current in their world. Bullying, because at that time, that's when the suicides with the children started becoming a noticeable thing. It started making the news. So we started addressing that. We talked about the sexting because we had issues come up in our school where before the laws changed, parents were being removed from homes because, you know, parents had the cell phones in their names. Right. And you don't know necessarily what your children are doing. We had an incident where one student sent a picture of her top to a boy. And it became an issue. And rather than creating a culture of fear, the police department, the local police department worked with our school to talk with our children about what that actually meant and what the repercussions were. We also had after school activities called, which I don't think is unique just to our, that particular school, sister to sister, where we talk to the girls about every issue that could possibly be facing them in their world. You know, we didn't do like etiquette, you know, when you go to a ball, we didn't do that. We were working our way to that, but we had to address the issues that they were dealing with as young ladies there. For our gentlemen, we had mentors that would come in and teach them, you know, about how to be a man, what that looks like, because, you know, in a lot of urban areas, and it's, you know, it's not like it's just unique really to African American children, but fathers are not present all the time, you know. Right. So we created that village, and our kids treated our house, you know, our school, like it was family. And so I loved that, and that made my job easier. And our teams were cohesive, and we were all about making sure that we were all on the same page, which created a culture of hope for our students. And if they didn't do well, they were trying to figure out, what do I need to do better academically mm-hmm. and behavior wise? And of course, you can't save them all, but we saw, you know, and it shouldn't be about the test scores, but the test scores always come up. We saw test scores increase. We saw academic progress. We saw students seeking out help on their own. We saw them bringing their parents in to showcase what they were doing. We saw our kids bringing the community in. And that's very different, because usually you're trying to figure out, what do we need to do? And so I love my charter school. I'm not even focusing on the management of it, because that's a whole different thing.
Right.
But with regard to what was happening in there, it was amazing. And I know people feel different ways about charter schools and funding. At the end of the day, having worked on both sides, I think it's about, what are you doing for the kids? Because if you're getting funding from whomever and you're not doing anything with it, and there's not a positive outcome for the students, you might as well not have the money at all.
Right.
So, you know, me sitting down with a student, if I get my paycheck, that has nothing to do with how many laptops I have in the computer in my classroom or how much paper I have to give to them. Sitting down with a student has nothing to do with the funding.
Right.
Them being connected to you has nothing to do with the funding. You know, that's something that you can't purchase. And so that was the beauty of that school. And I appreciate those years because it prepared me to, you know, to figure out how to connect with students when I had the culture shock of coming here.
Right.
So I'm sorry if that was long-winded.
Oh, no, you're good. You're good. And when you were at the charter school, what grade or grades did you teach in subject?
I taught 7th and 8th grade.
English.
Funny. My first year, I was hired in, but they would do co-teaching, true co-teaching. And I was considered a guest. They called me a guest teacher because I didn't have my own classroom. And so I would do intervention, and I would go in. I was doing like base math skills. Even though I'm ELA, I was helping them with just supplementary skills, vocabulary. And then I started co-teaching 7th grade with one of the teachers, English language arts. And my last 2 years there, I did 8th grade language arts.
Okay. And fast forward to what you're doing now. Is there any particular curriculum that you are utilizing in the state of Alabama for 8th grade English?
We have our district uses, we're on Common Core, and then Alabama has its own standards intertwined. And then our district works on determining exactly what standards we are required to cover. They use basic, I shouldn't say basic, but basic ELA text that's intertwined with that. And then our software probably speaks more to where they start to become more defined. I shouldn't say software, our technology. So we use a program called Edgenuity. Have you heard of that?
It sounds familiar.
It's ELA based, and it's videos, and it allows the students to kind of move at their own pace, where it's standards driven. And we use that for our intervention. And then when you go into our schools, while we are following that curriculum with a recommended pacing guide, and we are now, you know, being asked or encouraged to increase our technology use, our particular school is using a few programs. We use ReadWorks, which we use for differentiation.
Okay.
And there's a program called MobiMax.
I know MobiMax. MobiMax is good.
Yes. We use that for the data, and it's not about the data, but you know, at the end of the day, they want to know, what are you doing? We know that you're teaching whatever the standard is. How do you know that they've gotten it? What if they don't get it? And so, that program actually allows us to, pull data, that makes sense. Instead of a teacher sitting there trying to figure out who passed the test, who didn't pass the test, let me make a graph. So yeah, it's centered all around Common Core, but then Alabama's standards are intertwined in there, and we just pull from that and try to use technology to help us reach where we're not able to in the classroom.
Two quick things. So MobiMax, I love MobiMax. Our school district, we use MobiMax for maybe 3 years, three or 4 years. Last year we stopped, and we don't have it this year, but somehow I'm still able to log in and access all of the lessons and everything, which is great. And I don't know if that's going to expire on me, so I need to double check that. But I love MobiMax because it takes a standard, you know, like you said, Common Core standard in ELA, and it breaks it down. I mean, it breaks it down in ways that, you know, collaborating with my peers, and, you know, you try to figure out what prerequisite skills is this standard requiring. If you go to MobiMax, it will show you. And it will show you details of the standard that maybe you and your peers didn't consider. At least that's been my experience. So I do like MobiMax. I do think some of the lessons are extremely lengthy, though. But I'm the type of teacher where I'd rather slow down. I mean, a pacing guide is nice, but I'd rather slow it down. And if we don't get everything finished in that one class period, I kind of shrug my shoulders and say, I don't care. We'll continue tomorrow, you know,
Exactly.
Because for me, the rigor and going in depth and making sure the kids have a thorough understanding and not just surface understanding, that means so much more to me in the progress and performance of my students than, oh, did you teach this standard? And did you guys cover this? Anytime I hear the verbiage cover, that means that there's not real teaching and learning going on. Like, I understand what people are saying, but it's like, I'm not trying to cover, you know, 15 standards before we go to fall break. If we, you know, if we focus on the foundation of ELA, which is, you know, thinking of Common Core, those first three, arguably maybe those first four standards, and reading literature and reading informational text, if you can get your kids to do that by fall break, trust me, they will be fine come, you know, state assessment, you know, whatever state you're in, they will be more than fine. Because if I got a kid who can cite textual evidence, they know what theme is, they know what central idea is, they know how to find them, they know how to analyze their development, we're good. We're better than good. Because most kids can't do that because they've got teachers in front of them. And, you know, Lord bless their heart, they're probably really good teachers. But sometimes you just don't know until you know that you just can't cover standards. Like, you got to make sure these kids really thoroughly understand it. And you have to be able to assess them in multiple ways, not just say multiple choice tests, you know, make your kids write. You know, I encourage my kids to write every single day, even if it's just a short constructive response, even if it's just in their journal and it's a reflection. I need my kids thinking in written expression every single day. So, yeah, so I do. I love Moby Max. And the second thing I was going to ask you about your standards, are they that much different from Common Core, or is it just the verbiage and some slight differences?
The verbiage is a little different. And looking at, you know, ours, you know, when you do state testing and you can pull the data and it will, for the one that we use, it allows us to look at the standards that the students are not getting, which is much more helpful than you didn't understand key ideas and details. I don't know what that means until you give me some specific focus on that.
Right.
So in us being able to look at the standards that they're being tested on, we see that we were looking at it and we're like, what is this? And it's the Alabama standard, which doesn't have, you know, your RL.8.1A.
Okay.
And so it's almost like a conversational standard. So when you read it, it doesn't appear as formal. And so it's just a little lax in the language, but it's their standard nevertheless.
And from the Department of Education in Alabama, do you feel like you've had, as an educator, the support you need? And although we don't want to teach to the test, we do know that, you know, that data is important. And it, you know, it's important because a lot of decisions as far as human capital, you know, HR is concerned, is made based on and what programs are implemented and what type of funding is available, what grants might be available, is based on that data. Because when you're dealing with politicians and those who have never actually been in the classroom, they have to have something tangible to hold on to. And education has slowly but surely moved its way into being an actual industry. It's a business. And so anytime you're dealing with business, they're going to look at the numbers and make decisions based on those numbers. Do you feel like you've got the support as far as being able to effectively teach to the test? And I hate to call it that, but to some extent, I think we all have to teach to the test, even though that's not what we aim for.
Yes. Everything that you said is true. And it is, I think it's that that knife in the back to teachers.
Yeah.
Because when you're in the classroom, you don't see capita. You see life.
Right.
You see babies trying to figure out a whole lot before you start writing on the board what we're covering today. And so, I guess I've just been very blessed in where I've been positioned. We literally just had a conversation about this with my department, our principal and our counselor, talking about this testing and, you know, what is required and, you know, what is the data going to say? And our first order of business is always teach your kids.
Right.
Make sure that they have what they need, because you cannot ask them to, you know, show so much growth if you haven't done the base work, you know. And I know it's not just unique to our district or our school. Your kids come and they're deficient, you know, in areas that you feel like, well, you should have learned this 5 years ago or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And you can harp on it all day, but it doesn't change the fact that they don't know it. And so while we are required to give this data at the end, you know, our school has been very proactive in creating, our goal is the kids, but our principal is, I don't know if we think he's magic. He's done a very good job at creating a safe place for the teachers to feel like, listen, this is what we have to do. This test is coming. Right. We have to have the data. The goal is to make sure that our students are progressing and making gains. However, we have to be realistic in our approach to it. You know, you can't get the data and then say, we have to cover 27 standards by Christmas. And you have to, you know, you guys have to, you have to give me 250 point get no, because you're going to scare them to death. And his focus has always been figure out what your kids need. Use the data to help you do that and be realistic about what you can do. If you have 150 kids, you can't expect all 150 to knock it off the charts. Right. You have to give them all the support that they need, encourage them, you know, to do their best in the classroom, because the test is coming no matter what. But the classroom, you know, is every day. So provide that support for them. Work with your team to figure out best practices, things that are working for them. Don't try to kill yourself trying to get them there. Because when they leave here, you know, the test doesn't stop them from going to the next grade.
Right.
Will they be ready? Will they have what they need for the next quarter when you have to raise the standard, when you have to increase the rigor? So we get that support in our school, and we do use the data to drive our instruction. Mm-hmm. But we do not use that or look at that data, I should say, as a nail in the coffin, you know, because sometimes the expectation is unrealistic and we acknowledge what it is, but he always tells us, you have to do what you can do. I expect you to do your best. And we're going to talk about, you know, some methods, but don't get anxiety and pass that on to your students about this test, because it's a test. It means something, but at the end of the day, they leave you.
Right.
And that test is just sitting there, and then they take another test, you know. So he's been amazing at helping us figure out how to use that data to drive our instruction mm-hmm. on a daily basis, as opposed to just the test. Because if you're using the data to help you figure out what you need to teach, mm-hmm. then you're not necessarily teaching just to the test. You're teaching to the expectations of your grade levels
right.
Curriculum.
Right. Right. Definitely. So let me ask you that. And I'm so glad you said that. And you sound like you have a great leader at your school who has a really good perspective, much better than most principals that I've met or heard about. But nevertheless, I almost forgot my question there. I think I did. Ah, it was a good one, too. I'll remember. It'll come back to me. Yeah, it'll come back to me. But let's fast forward a little bit here. So you are also in a doctorate program. Is that correct? You're working on your EDD?
Yes.
What is the motivation behind your EDD? What are you aiming to do with that? And how's your experience been in doctorate school or doctoral school?
So I when I got my master's, that was my path to getting certified, because I already had a bachelor's in English. And I like education, but my principal at the charter school, I just thought she was amazing. And I saw how she got us to do things that, you know, I probably wouldn't have, you know, if her delivery of it had been different. And I saw her trying to change the lives of the students and changing the mindset of the teachers. And I'm like, that is amazing. And that is powerful in itself. And she didn't carry herself in an arrogant way. She was one of us, but she always told everybody in that school from the top to the bottom, there's more in you. And I would like to see you, you know, tap into that potential. And I just felt like I could do more to be effective. And then I started my doctoral program before I came here to Alabama. And the goal was to inspire teachers and change how students were being taught, because I know what that feels like. You feel defeated. You feel overwhelmed. You feel insignificant. You feel inefficient. And I wanted to be one of those people that, you know, provided the light to the teachers, because if the teachers feel inspired and encouraged and they feel it's possible, then you see that trickle over into the students. Mm-hmm. I have, you know, one class left with that, and I had to put it on hold because I started another program. But ultimately, I would like to be a principal. I didn't know that I wanted that really until last year. I was like, I could do an assistant principal and work with teachers at curriculum. But then I got this new principal and another light. I've just been blessed in that aspect. And so I want to do that here in the States for a while. But then I want to go overseas and see how education happens in other countries. I think there's a deficiency in our country about what it really means to educate a student.
Agreed.
And there's not a hunger for it here. And that is sad. And when you watch television and hear about, you know, kids walking through war zones to get to school, or schools where kids are doing amazing and they're not stressed about tests, I would like to know what that is. And I believe that it has to be transferable. It can't just be isolated to a particular, you know, continent or country. So I'm always fascinated by how people learn. And I want to be able to get some of that and bring that back here and share that with principals and with teachers so that they can continue to do, you know, the hard work of getting our kids educated. The numbers are the numbers, but they need a base education. I don't care what your job is. You know, you need a base education, because thinking is an everyday occurrence in life.
Yes.
And I'm sure that you can attest to the fact that sometimes you come across a kid who doesn't, and it sounds ridiculous, but they don't know how to think.
Right.
You know, they cannot rationalize. And so we talk about making good choices. Well, good choices does have to do with the maturing of your brain, but it also has to do with how you process the information.
Right.
And if they're not being taught how to think,
right,
not what to think, but how to think, then they're going to be, you know, at a deficiency in every walk of their life. You know, if they get a high school diploma, once they get a job, you know, we have to make decisions every day,
right,
about what to do, what to say when you're at work, what to wear,
mm-hmm,
you know, and we're all inundated with, you know, things in front of our faces. But if you don't know how to process the thinking, you know, or the best tools, the best strategies, the best words, it's all for nothing. And so I think if I can bring some of what goes on in other places back and implement that into instructional practice, I think that it could really be a positive, as opposed to, you know, America just having its own standards, because in all honesty, it's not working so well. And that's not my thoughts. That's facts. I mean, you can pull up where we are,
right,
in the world with education. We're not at the top.
We're pretty low. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
In Alabama is even lower. And so that concerns me greatly, because I see these kids and they're not dumb. You know, they're not incapable of learning. They just lack the resources and the tools in some cases to get to the next level. And I think that's in every classroom. So I don't want us as a country, my district, my state, to continually be at the low end of the totem pole, so to speak.
Right. I always say status quo is not working. I don't care what the status quo is. It's not working.
Right.
It's exactly. Not working. We can definitely improve it 24/7 mm-hmm. every day. Well, thank you for sharing that. I was going to ask you something about the doctorate program. Yeah. What's your, do you have a dissertation topic yet?
Well, I did. When I got here, I was working on it, and it was about teacher efficacy being affected through student or school, district, and university partnerships, but that changed. So now my focus or my question really is about diversity in education. And I don't mean like, you know, various students or, you know, from different backgrounds or even ethnic groups for teachers. I mean, we have all these trainings, and I'm sure you have experienced this, where they talk to us about diversity and poverty and socioeconomics, and you get all that stuff, and then you go to work. Mm-hmm. And you're asked to consider these things. And I see examples every day, and I have for the last 15 years, where I don't see it being considered when you're instructing. So you're not using your diversity training. You're not considering the diversity. And I'm not talking about skin color. I'm talking about perhaps you were raised in a middle class family and you don't even know what it means to have the lights off unless your mother turned them off, right, as opposed to kids who go home and they're in the dark because there is no power every day.
Right.
Or not able to take a bath or not living in a house.
Right.
You know, and I'm not necessarily talking about homeless. There is a level in working in a rural area. You learn that there are levels before homelessness that you didn't even know existed.
Yeah, I've got,
you know,
I've got students who live in the local motels and hotels in Millington. And I know for sure that they live there. So I guess that'd be technically homeless, because they don't have an address where you can, you know, send things home to, per se. I've got kids who actually right next to Walmart in Millington, there's a trailer park. And some of these trailers are not in the best of conditions. I've heard of kids sleeping on different, you know, people's couches and floors. I've heard of kids sleeping in their parents' cars or vans. So I 100% agree with you there. Like, there is different levels to homelessness and different conditions that our kids are going through that, you know, yeah, like you said, you go through these culturally sensitive or diversity trainings, and are we really prepared or do we really know how to implement that training when it deals with socioeconomics? And I'd argue we probably do not.
Yeah. And that is concerning to me. And, you know, with myself included, because I had to do a self check. Do I think about, you know, the fact that this particular kid didn't sleep anywhere last night, literally did not sleep anywhere, or they haven't eaten, or they're angry because their clothes haven't been washed? Mm-hmm. You know, and they're being made fun of. I mean, there's so many levels of it. And then even looking at the faculty, you know, does the administration, does the district consider those, the backgrounds? And I know that, you know, there's lots of red tape about that, but do you consider that in placement of teachers? You know, I've had conversations with several people over the years about how a position is filled or why a position is filled. And, you know, I don't know the truth behind it, but it does leave one to question what is truly considered when you place a administrator or a teacher in a position. And does that filter into what you're considering, what you want for your students? And are they able to consider those those things, you know. I'm an urban girl. I'm used to lots of noise, and my parents, you know, have always been middle class. I had to adjust my thinking with rural because I was in Detroit, so I understood what that was. Right. I didn't live that life with, you know, kids living in, you know, around gunshots and moving every 6 months. But, you know, there's always, you know, I got a family member who lives, you know, wherever, or you're exposed to it. I didn't know what this was. And so I've had to change my thinking, mm-hmm. which has changed how effective I am in the classroom. And so I don't necessarily have an answer. I'm interested more in, is that something that we as educators consider? Because in schools where it is considered, I'll just use as an example, I mean, the Ron Clark Academy is not a secret. If you are in education, you know about that school. Those kids do well. Mm-hmm. You know, their test scores speak for themselves. They have the same kind of kids coming in and out that most of us do. Kids with problems, kids who don't have problems, kids with parents, kids who don't have parents, you know, socioeconomic issues. But something transforms in that school. There is an expectation, you know, of what we need to do to reach the kids, what we won't focus on, what's important. And so when I see that, I'm like, that it works. It doesn't necessarily have to be your cup of tea, but it works. And then I see other things, and it just concerns me that diversity is just something that we have paid for trainings, but we don't see it, or they only consider it with skin color. Well, you know, it goes a lot deeper than that, a lot deeper.
Totally agree. So what's one thing that really upsets you or motivates you as a Black educator in 2018? What is something that you see that needs to be addressed as far as Black educators are concerned?
I would like to see, and it's concerning because of the things that I've heard from parents, but I would love to see more Black male educators outside of the positions of football coaches.
Yeah, I get called coach so many times, even by my assistant principal, and I say, "What do I coach? Reading comprehension? Academic writing? What exactly do I coach?" So in that sense, yeah, I do, but I don't coach a sport. Never have. Probably never will because of the time commitment, and I'm just not that interested in it. But yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead. But yeah, okay. I don't. I'm a Black man. Right. Yeah, I'm not a coach. I'm a teacher, an educator.
Right.
A highly effective one.
It's funny, and we laugh, and it seems so minute, but I've been teaching 17 years, and off the top of my head, in the classroom, I'm just talking about in the classroom, I'm not talking about coaching. I can only recall two Black male teachers in the classroom. Two.
Wow.
And that bothers me because if you are in a metropolitan city, Chicago, Memphis, Nashville, Miami, Atlanta, there are a lot of Black boys, and they all have a Black mama or a Black grandmother. And so we're not lacking in that area in the classroom. They don't have anyone that looks like them. And if they don't make the football team or the basketball team, they don't get that presence in their lives. And that is concerning to me. I saw, I went to a conference and met a Black male kindergarten teacher, and I almost fell over from shock and excitement at the same time. And he shared that, you know, people had concerns because they felt like if he's a male and he's teaching kindergarten, then mm-hmm. he must have some secret issues.
Mm-hmm. Michael, you know, Jackson.
And I.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said Michael Jackson. Continue.
Yeah. You know, and that was offensive. And so I said, and my brother, you know, said that if he became a teacher, that he would want to teach like K-5. And I'm like, why don't you just do it? And he gave me this look, and I knew what it was. We didn't speak it, but I knew what it was. And I said to him, I said, that's so sad, because how many of those kids who go home and they don't have a father will be more excited to come to school because they're like, oh, you know, Mr. So-and-so said I was pretty yesterday, or he told me I was smart, or he told me I did great. To get it from someone else, to get it from someone who's a missing piece in your life, or they look like you. You know, my son used to tell me all the time when he was little, because he had a single parent home, I want somebody that looks like me. That spoke volumes to me, because I'm in the classroom and I'm like, this is my kid. You know, he has the village. He had a father who was not in the class, in the home, but he wanted somebody on a daily basis that looked like him. And I thought, if my kid thinks like that, what is going on with the 100-something kids that come across me every day? And so that bothers me. When I was in Michigan, one of the colleges up there had a program where they were asking for Black males to attend their education program through an alternative certification program because they were lacking, and giving them extended time. There were scholarships that were available. And that program did well for the time that it was up. But then I found out recently, since I've been here, that school is no more.
Wow.
So that's concerning, because it was a viable option for people who maybe thought, you know, I could maybe teach. Right. You know, it's a hard job, but it's not an impossible job. No. If you feel like you can teach, then you probably should be teaching that. Maybe I'll teach today, you know, but if you feel drawn to it, that's probably the thing. And I don't like the stigma that's attached to it for Black males. Mm-hmm. I do not like that. I go to conferences every year, 2 or 3 times a year, and I can count the Black men with both of my hands. And there's usually 500 or 600 people there. Wow. And I can just use both of my hands. And that is very sad. That really does pierce me when I think about, you know, an issue in as a Black educator, that part is lacking.
Yeah, I recently tweeted out, I wish I worked with more guys. And I didn't mean that to be offensive, but I kind of isolate myself sometimes because it's me and it's another male teacher there, actually African-American teacher there. There's two of us and an entire district who just teach and don't coach. There's just two of us, including myself.
Wow.
Yeah. An entire district. And there are other African Americans in the classroom. But like you said, they're either a PE teacher or they're a coach. One of my assistant principals, Dr. Gordon, really good administrator, really good person overall. He's African American. And that's it. So it's three of us in the building overall. It's just educators, two in the classroom who do not teach. And, you know, sometimes I recognize, like on my hall, in previous halls that I've been on, whether seventh grade or sixth grade hall, it's just with all of the women, like sometimes like there's like cattiness there and I'm not there for that. Right. Like the objective is kids. So yes. I just like if somebody's like got some little drama going on, I don't want to deal with that. Like I don't deal with that at all. I just close my door and teach to the best of my ability and just leave it at that. But yeah, I do wish that when I go to conferences, when I go to professional developments off campus, I also have been doing some work with the state down in Nashville. And when I'm down there, you know, I'm not doing this intentionally, but I will count and I will look and see how many African Americans are in here. And
yes.
You know, usually on one finger and one hand. And it's me. Right. And then I see four women, or maybe I can go to my second hand. I see 6 or 7 Black women. And then there's me and I'm looking for another guy. Wait, I see a guy in the suit. Nope. He's here for a different conference. He's not an educator. Mm. And so it saddens me sometimes because I feel like I don't have anyone to connect to. It's one of my motivations to actually starting the podcast is to you know, try to bring in, you know, more of this community for all Black educators, but also for males as well, too, Black educators who are males as well, too. Now, I'll be honest, on this show, I've only had one Black male guest. One.
Wow.
Now, that doesn't mean that there has, you know, I haven't had conversations with more, but we haven't been able to, you know, make schedules align yet. But I've only had one officially, who was William. And I think that was episode 2 or 3. So, yeah, that's telling. And, you know, you look at the statistics, African-American males are less than 2% across the country in the classroom. I bet that number is even lower if we say, okay, who just teaches a core academic subject and you do not coach anything? That number is even less. And it's not to downplay or discredit coaches who are African-American males, but it's a different level of focus when you're a science teacher, an English teacher, a math teacher, a social studies teacher, and that's what you focus on. Not the basketball team, not the football team. Nothing wrong with that. Sports is important. But academically, I do feel like it's very important. Personally, I do feel it's very important through observational learning that kids get the opportunity to see a strong Black male using their brain, you know, using their brain in front of them. You know, those think alouds, those read alouds, those that questioning, and really saying like, wow, like this is possible. This is capable. Even if, you know, a Black boy doesn't want to become a teacher as he grows up, at least he gets the opportunity to see, okay, we can do intellectual things. We don't always have to catch or throw a ball, or, you know, we don't always have to, you know, run down a field. Like, we can actually make a living working with our mind.
Right.
And so I think that's a beautiful thing. And I'm grateful that you shared that, you know, about your own son, is that he wanted, you know, a Black male representing his class. Representation matters. It really, really matters. So, yeah, that's amazing. So let me ask you this. Last thing I'll ask you.
Sit down. I'm going through the permission slips. Jamarcus, do you have a chaperone? You got no chaperone. You staying right here at the school. I'm not dealing with that this year. The cafeteria don't have enough lunches. If your parents meet at the field trip, they're going to have to pay their own way. We ain't got it. Marlon, did you sign this permission slip? So your mama's scribbling her signature in crayon now. You can't even cheat right. How you going to sign and spell your name wrong?
It's the real zoo right here.
Mr. Brown.
Yeah.
The principal wanted to know if you can drive your own car to the field trip because she didn't get enough buses.
I'm just happy to be leaving campus. Jadarius, you must be crazy if you think I'm gonna let you go on this field trip. Why your permission slip even in here? This is not a test run. You don't need to go outside because you act bad as all outside in here.
Two of y'all go to the cafeteria and get them lunches. Get to the zoo. If anybody missing, we sure gonna miss you. Please leave your bad conduct at this school, because where you act a fool is where I'm gonna act a fool. Please don't feed the animals. Tony, last time you gave the ducks taki, son. Now we got a duck running around the zoo with high blood pressure now because of you. They got little kidneys. They can't process that processed food. Please don't act like y'all normally act. Hey, when I call y'all name, do like Spike Lee and get on the bus. Line up. Forget you. I don't even know why we going to the zoo, because there's a jungle in here.
What's one recommendation that could be a movie, a documentary, a TV show, a book, a poem, a scripture, anything, whatever you have. What's one recommendation you'd have for Black educators listening?
Oh my gosh. Be your truth. That I would say that. Be your truth. I think sometimes when we walk in, there are stereotypes attached to us as Black educators. Sometimes we make the assumption that the stereotypes are there. We feel certain types of pressure. And I think that has to do with, you know, sometimes having feeling like we have to work harder or prove ourselves. And then you become something that you're not. And it affects your ability to do what you do well. Being who you are is the easiest thing in the world to do. And when you walk into the classroom, students appreciate authenticity because they can smell a lie a mile away. And if you want to connect, if you want to be effective, and sometimes just the relationship is, you know, what some kids need, you need to be who you are and not feel pressured or afraid to excel as a Black educator, as opposed to trying to fit the status quo. I've learned that, and I've been so much happier the last couple of years and just, you know, being my true self. And it's not, it means that sometimes I don't conjugate the verbs when I'm addressing my students because I need them to get the gist of what I'm trying to say. Sometimes it means that my delivery is not as polished as it should be, but my end result is always on point. And so I think sometimes, you know, the cosmetic part of, you know, fitting, you know, you want to fit in, you can fit in and stand out at the same time. And I think you have to just be your truth. And that it was harder for me not to do that. And so I feel so much better now that I can just, you know, I am the Black teacher. There are four of us at our school. And we've kind of embraced that. You know, we're the Black teachers. You can see that we are. Mm-hmm. But this is how we are. We're not all, I hate to say this on this show, we're not all, you know, displaying ghetto antics on the side, and we're not all proper at the same time. But we do know how to conjugate verbs, you know, and speak formally. But it's not always necessary to do what you need to do in the classroom, because I don't come there, you know, to make friends. I enjoy the people that I work with, but I come to get those kids to the next level. Mm-hmm. You know, if they pass the test, that's great. But, you know, that should be everybody's goal. And if your goal is to teach children, then you have to be your truth, because that's what we're asking them to be. We're asking them to be who they are and you know, not be afraid to seek out their dreams. And you can't come in there being somebody else and expect to be effective. So be your truth, Black educators. Just walk in who you are and embrace that on a daily basis. And people have to respect who you are. They just have to respect that's what it is. They don't necessarily have to like it, but they really do respect when you're just being your true self.
What can I say? Mamba out.
Thank you for listening to the Black Scholars Podcast. For more information, sometimes go to blackscholarspublishing.com.
You just gotta
go.
You will never know what you could ever be. If you never try, you will never see. Stayed in Africa, we ain't never leave. So one no slaves in our history. One no slave ships, one no misery. Call me crazy.